I was such a tough son of a bitch when I got here, and you've made me into a wimp. My name is John. I'm an alcoholic.
John, where are you from?
Above paradise. And I have to tell you, as I announced at another meeting, you all can rot in hell if you ever expect me to introduce myself as a visitor to Saturday Night Live. And I'm not at all concerned about the booze. I will never be a visitor to Saturday Night Live. This has been a fundamental part of my life, and since the day we opened the doors, and it always will be, because I have received so much. I was thinking about the gifts that I've received, and I was thinking about my son-in-law for a couple of reasons. I for those of you, just as a piece of information, I've had a busy day today, and I want to pass on a little piece of information. It's not a commercial, it's just a statement of fact. You'll hear some rumors. My son-in-law and my sponsee, John Hoppen, had a minor heart attack today, and he's fine. If you've got to have a heart attack, please have a heart attack in the hospital having an EKG. So he will be home Monday, or that's the plan. And so I just, because there's a lot of stuff going on, and I want everybody to get the facts up front. And while I was thinking about John and just wanted to pass on that public information message, I was thinking of another son-in-law I had by the name of Michael O'Brien. And I feel the way one of his dying sentences, he was also one of the co-founders of Saturday Night Live. Is one of his messages that he's, when he was still could talk before he died. I wished there's some way I could thank Saturday Night Live for all that Saturday Night Live has given to me. And that's exactly the way I feel tonight. You see, because I know that some of you, because you told me that, unless you're liars, you told me that you come here because I'm speaking. Not all of you, thank God, but some of you did. And the man who came here, I was talking to my dear friend Diane. And we were looking out, and we knew both that some of us were here because I was speaking. And I said, but they didn't know what the son of a bitch that came in the door. Diane is, to my knowledge right now, the only one that was here when I walked in the door. And I was not a happy person. And I certainly was not then the person that I am today, and I hopefully in another 25 years I will not be the person I am tonight. The odds of me making another 25 are remote to nil. So I'll guarantee you I'd be a hell of a lot different than I am tonight. For those of you who don't know, I am a family man. I have always been a family man, but today, and because of the last 25 years, I have really been a family man. I have a large family, and some of you do not know that. I have a large family. I have 8 children. I have 23 grandchildren. I have 20 great-grandkids. And I always like to say that because, you see, you may not like a damn thing I've said, but by God, you have to walk out and say that he was surely great. And since my oldest great-grandson is 17, that'll make me a great-great. And now you really have to know how good I am. But I was nothing but a miserable, rotten son of a bitch, incapable of loving, incapable of sharing, incapable of doing anything. Because, you see, I suffer from a disease of alcoholism that is the best description that I know of. It's contained in the foreword to the first edition that says that Alcoholics Anonymous, this fellowship, have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Hopeless. My life was hopeless in both mind and body. Now, I didn't know the body, but I knew it was by mind because left to my own devices, I had managed to destroy each and everything that had any value to me by the time I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was talking with a dear friend here earlier today, and I was saying that I have been blessed. I have been so blessed by my involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous, and can take absolutely no credit for anything. I don't even take credit for coming into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come here because a bottle beat me to death, because I didn't know it had beaten me to death. I died as far as being beat to death 7 years before I hit the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, when all hell broke loose one more time and I knew I was a failure in every department of life, and there was not a damn thing I could do other than to continue to live, to give my kids the best start I knew how to give them, and that was only financial. I taught my children I loved them because I had to, because they were my parents and my children, and I had to love them. Not that I wanted to, and not that I knew how to love it, just that I had to. And oh God, what a curse it was, because it condemned me to live in a world that I did not like. Condemned me to be, when I hit the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, constitutionally incapable of living without hurting the people I wanted most of all. And I couldn't leave them, because I, in my deep inside of me, I loved them so much. And I didn't know that. I was afraid of it. Love is a tremendous thing. When I came here, I did not know. I was so painful, and most of you have known this, that your world shrinks as you get into the disease of alcoholism, and you shy away from these people, and you shy away from that, because you get it so goddamn painful to care about some people, and they say things, and they hurt you, and you knew that you hurt them, and so you shut yourself off from the world and all as many people as you can. And I was condemned because I had so many children to live, and I was hurting them, and I didn't know why. I'm one of those who did not know when I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous what the problem was. You told me what the problem was. For those who do not know, and many of you do, and I'm amazed that you managed to come back here and listen to the same old story. It's the only one I got. I remember I was speaking at my first big deal in front of a couple thousand people down in Yosemite once, and I was the night before, and I was trying to figure out, God, I got to make a massive presentation. And I looked at my record, and I said, God, it's not good enough. I wonder if I have a chance to get out tonight and really get a big one. But I only got one. The story is that God is, my understand, God inspired a young man, a nosy member of Alcoholics Anonymous, to come to a saloon where I was, drinking bourbon whiskey on the 11th of March, 1976. I was finishing my fourth drink when that little slob came, not little, he's bigger than I, he came in and sat down beside me and ordered a disgusting Coke and started talking about the meeting he had just left and what he had found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought he was miserable, I thought he was rotten, and he was disturbing my bourbon, and I don't like talking to people when I'm drinking. Unless I'm really drunk. My daughter's not here. None of my family are here tonight because of some of the events, but I love it when they're in the room because they can tell you he was miserable. I used to lecture my family together, but I'm sitting in a bar drunk, and they pretended, oh, God, that's a miserable story. I won't bother you with. But I'm sitting in this saloon, and this sucker comes in and sits down beside me and tells me about you. And then he asked me if I wanted to go to an AA meeting, and instead of my mouth betrayed me, instead of saying, get the hell out of here, my mouth said yes. And as I say, that was somewhere around 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night, and I had that fourth drink. I do not know if I finished it or not, but I hadn't had a drink from that second to this. Now, you can't. The compulsion to drink was lifted from me. I did not have another drink from that moment to that, and that's over 25 years and almost a month. That was on the 12th. My sobriety date is the 12th of March, 1976, and I can't even take credit for it. I didn't like you when I came in. You were miserable. You treated me rude. You laughed at the wrong... You see? I just offered a painful story, and you laughed at it. That's what the hell they did when the first guy insulted me, and I like to remind old Bill Joplin, bless his heart. I walked up, and Bob introduced me to Bill, and Bill said, oh, you have a drinking problem. And I said, well, doesn't everybody? And that son of a bitch said no. That was my first resentment. The second person I met was my second resentment, who inferred that I didn't have enough guts to stay sober for 90 days, and I came back at you. You know, I went home that night, and I bought a book because there were some things that you said that really appealed to me. And I told my wife that I'm probably an alcoholic, and she said, we got a name for you. You're not a jackass. My lovely bride always knew how to share. Disgusting truth that was so painful when we were together. So I said, I read the book last night, and that same night, and I thought it was a piece of trash. And this is my story because it just happened this way. That was on a Tuesday night, on the 16th of March. I was still not drinking. And my friend asked me if I wanted to go to an AA meeting on the following Friday. And I said, I don't want to go back where those other guys are. And he said, no, we'll go to a new place. And then I went, and the quality of the people were vastly superior to the first place I went. And my friend asked me on the following Tuesday if I wanted to go to another meeting, and I said, yes, I'm looking forward to it. I want to find if that guy's still sober. And I went there, and it's amazing how those people changed in a week. They were just as nice and as friendly and outgoing as they could possibly be, and they laughed at the right places, too. And nobody insulted me. They talked a little weird, though, I'll tell you that. Standing in the hallway, Peppermint Patty, I remember that talk. Standing in the hallway, you can't close one door until you let go of it, so you cannot walk into the next door unless you let go of the door that you're standing in. I was standing in the hallway. My friend asked me to come to a meeting on the following Friday, and I said, yes, I'm looking forward to it. And that night I fell in love. I fell in love with you. My heart, this heart expanded just a little bit because suddenly I was in love. I was in love with what you had to offer. If you were not lying, you had everything I wanted. And I wanted it so desperately because anything I had was better than what you had to offer. You see, what I knew, and because of some teachings, I was so fortunate enough that same day I happened to get a set of tapes from a man called Chuck C. And I became absolutely mesmerized by that. And what he taught me there by just listening to those tapes that I had, this is what I learned from listening to him. I can't say what Chuck taught me. What I learned from him is the fact that because of my drinking and my actions while drinking and the mental attitude that I had forfeited each and every right that I thought I ever had. I had forfeited. I had no longer any rights. I had no longer rights as a husband, as a father, or as a businessman or anything else. I'd forfeited them all because I drank them away. And not only that, because of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you promised me that if I was going to get back together with my wife or my family or any relationship, it must be on a new basis because the old basis didn't work. So I never tried to fix anything that was broken because I broke it and I break it. I can't fix it. Because that same man told me that if you work the 12 steps for the purpose by which the 12 steps are written for sobriety, the related disorders will take care of themselves. And I had a few related disorders. Now, this ice queen that I was married to used to live in the ice palace. That's called the bedroom. And I sat in my sumptuous couch where it was sometimes very cold. And a piece of information that this lovely lady that I was married to, who had turned rotten over the 15 years that we were married, she was such a wonderful creature when I married her. But she just turned worse and worse and worse and worse. And she's, for the last, according to her calculations, she used to kill me, to attempt to. Wasn't good at that either. She used to, in the dead of winter, when I was sleeping on my bed in the couch, I call it sleeping, she insisted I had passed out. She, in the dead of winter, she would turn off the furnace, open up all the doors and windows, and go to bed. And then she would wake up earlier in the morning and turn on the furnace and close all the doors and windows. And you see, I was a little puny in those days, and I had a little chronic bronchitis. And so she'd wake me up, and I'd cough and whine. She'd say, oh, honey, you better see the doctor. Because I would go to the doctor, and I'd get pneumonia. And according to her, her comment was that at least you didn't drink while you were in the hospital. She put me into the hospital the last 4 years of my life 16 times with pneumonia. So whenever I get a cold, it's always Peggy's fault. She weakened my condition so badly. And you know what she used to say? She used to say, well, alcoholics, when they want to kill somebody, will pick up a gun and shoot them. Al-Anons will plot. And plot. And her defense was, of course, whoever heard of anybody being convicted of murder by pneumonia? Now, that's the kind of witch that I was married to when I got sober. It's amazing how she changed almost immediately. It's absolutely amazing. You know, just a brief bit. I have a love story. I have a love story with you. I have a love story with Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a love story with my bride. I have a love story with my children. I have a love story with life. The lady, just a brief, I married first of all to my high school sweetheart. And she take the brunt of my alcoholism in Southern California. She was the mother of five of my little children. And I came to on a running drunk one time and found out that she had committed suicide. And I went absolutely insane and bizarre. I did the thing that only I know how to do. I did it. I got mad. I got enraged and I went out of my mind. And according to the records, it took 8 firemen, 4 policemen, my son, a brother-in-law, and a best friend to put me in a straitjacket. And I demolished an apartment building because they wanted me to sit down and I wanted to stand up. And that's how it went. And I remember coming to in a straitjacket, strapped down in the psychiatric wing of the Los Angeles General Hospital, looking up. And the doctor was looking down and I could listen to them talking, and the doctor was saying, the people were saying, good God, the guy's crazy, he's an absolute maniac, don't let him, dare him, let him loose, because there's a bunch of minor abrasions and a lot of stitches that had to be made to sew me up because I was bleeding in a lot of different places. The doctor saw me come to and he looked at me and he says, if I let you go, you won't hurt me, will you? And I couldn't answer him because I didn't, honest to God, know. All I could do was cry. Because I didn't know if I had 5 little girls alive. I didn't know if my wife was alive. I heard that she was dead. I crawled into a hole. I don't know if you've ever been in a hole. You crawl in that place and you know that you can't come out. You can stay there. You can stay retreated from the world inside yourself. And I'd sit in that goddamn shell, cell of the soft walls, and they'd have a little sliding door that they'd peek at you to find out if you're alive, and then they'd talk to you and you don't want to talk to them. And I kept wanting to disappear, and I couldn't disappear because I had to find out what happened to my little girls. And gradually I was able to get it proved to them. I didn't want to get out, but I was able to prove to them that that I was okay, and they let me out of there. It took quite a while. I was on parole to go to my wife's funeral, and I got my little girls back, and I came to Northern California. And the reason I came to Northern California, because Southern California, in the industry that I am involved in, was relatively small, and I was blackballed. I had blackballed in the industry by the corporation that I worked for. The corporation I worked for was a major corporation in 11 western states, and they felt that although I was an executive of that company, that I was projected a bad image. So they fired me while I was in the nut house. And my boss risked his job to hold me as an employee until he made sure the insurance paid for it. That's long before things got as nice as they are now. Okay. So I came to Northern California with my lovely daughters, 2 of them still in diapers, and I learned how to be a mother. Then I learned how to be a housekeeper. I learned how to keep house and work. So I was a single parent before single parent phrase was used. And I got pretty damn good at it, too. I expected you to laugh at that. Hey, I'll get a laugh any way I can get it. But I like to tell this story to show you my competency as a single parent is I had to learn how to iron, and this is in the days before wash and wear, and there are some of us should remember those days. And all my little girls had nothing but beautiful little dresses that all needed to be ironed. And my oldest girl had this magnificent peasant dress, which was dark brown with white lace ribbons all the way down it, and a white yoke and puff sleeves and lace. Oh, it was gorgeous. And when it's learning how to iron, if you're an old person like I am, you listen to your parents saying, oh, standing over in front of a hot iron all this time. I decided that, screw that, I'm going to learn how to iron sitting down. Well, I'm not dumb, don't you? So, if you ever want to try that, you are going to have to iron left-handed and right-handed. Because the only way to do it, other way, you're jumping up and down all the time, you might as well stand up. But I had come home, and I'd fix the kids' dinner, and we'd play, And I would give them a bath, and then we would tell them the stories, and I'd teach them their prayers, and then they would go to bed, and then I would do the housework with a bottle of bourbon in my hand, because I wouldn't drink in front of the children. And I was sitting there at ironing one night, sitting and ironing. God, I'm proud of that. And something happened. I lost my concentration for a moment, and I put a big scorch on the middle of that lace of her peasant dress. And this keen alcoholic of mine thought about it for a considerable period of time, and I came up with a solution. And a couple of hours later, I had finished it, and I scorched all the rest of the lace to match. And that little snot would never wear that dress again. I still have a resentment against her, and she's 53 now. Well, time went on, and I have to tell you, this is the way I met my second love of my life, because I dearly love my wife. But you see, one of the great regrets I had for my first bride was I had this love, this feeling of love that I could not express, because men can't talk that way. It's too painful to expose yourself and say, oh, you know what I mean. How in Christ's name would they know what you meant until you tell them what you meant? But this is me, and so the greatest regret that I had, and to some extent still do, that lovely lady died without really knowing I loved her. That's almost unforgivable. God forgave me, but that's almost unforgivable. You love somebody, you tell them about it. I didn't know that until I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, frivolous. But I'm talking about, you love somebody, you do something for them, you share, you invite them in your heart. And you see, as each year goes by, this little knot that called the heart or the ability to love is expanded. Because now I first come into you and I expanded and I start loving you. You know, and so the company that fired me while I was in the nut house and blackballed me from a job in the industry in Southern California, I went to work for a competitor in Northern California, who was willing to give me a whole new job because of my reputation. I became the chief engineer and division manager of a company in South San Francisco that no longer is there. And they in turn signed a contract with this lousy chicken shit outfit that I had worked for that fired me. And it meant that my company, the new company I was working for, was going to produce every damn piece of material that they wanted to buy. And I controlled everything that left that plant. And they used to call me and say, John. And I say, what do you want, you? Because I knew everybody there, because I used to be one of them. And some of them worked for me once. And I made it difficult for them. Don't tell me resentments are not, and revenge is not nice. I had a wonderful time with that. These people had to crawl to get every inch of the material out of my company. And one day a young, lovely lady from the production control department called up, and she seemed very knowledgeable. She had a pleasant voice, and she wasn't some miserable sucker that I've always known, and I liked her, and she seemed to know what the hell she was talking about. And the next day she called me again, and I treated her with all the respect, due respect that I have always tried to do with women, because my mother raised me properly. I do a much better job today than I did then. Believe me, I do. Anyway, finally I got so enamored by this young lady continually calling me because she was getting results, I finally pushed the button and told the 11 Western State Division managers that I'm no longer going to talk to you. I want nothing to do with you. If you want to talk to me, you talk to that girl in production control. She's the only person, including the owner of your goddamn company, that I'll talk to. So I talked to her quite a bit. Had a wonderful time, and I told her everything I knew about me. And she told me everything that she knew about her. And so I decided to hire her. I had a bunch of guys working for me that used to work for that company, and they knew her well. And they did not describe her the way I asked for a description of what she looked like, because I've never met her. They didn't describe the lady I met, I'll tell you that. I was expecting something different. They missed some very important parts. First of all, I was hugely attracted to this girl, and they did not tell me that she was as big as she was. Now, big is a nasty word. I would have never said that if my wife is here. Never. Big is a nasty thing to call women. Particularly if they have a weight problem. Bad. I was such a virile young man that I was insisting that I wouldn't look at anybody over 5 foot. And she was 5'6". They said she was a blonde, and she's not a blonde. She's something in between. They didn't tell me she wore glasses. And I didn't think women should wear glasses. Not that I was prejudiced, you understand. So anyway, I asked her out for dinner so that she would discuss employment. And I went out to dinner. We had a fabulous time. I asked her for a real date. And she wouldn't cancel a date she had with some miserable bastard, which infuriated me because she didn't understand how important I was. I persisted, and I finally prevailed, and I went and took her out, and she molested me. Absolutely, absolutely. I was one of the sickest suckers you would ever want to know, and she took absolute, total advantage of me. And she freely would declare that to you or anybody else who said it. And since I couldn't hire her because I don't believe in that sort of crap going on in the same office, I asked her to marry me one day. We were shopping in groceries for a picnic where the children were going to meet. She had two girls, a boy and a girl. I had my five little girls. And God, she had enough money to buy a bunk bed, my wedding ring, and her checkbook balanced. And she had a car and a television set, too. God, she was loaded. She had more things going for her than you can possibly do it. But we were between the peanut butter and the mayonnaise when I dropped on my knees and asked her if she would marry me. And I can assure you that's the best damn peanut butter and mayonnaise sandwich I've ever had in my entire life. Because I, being always the man with a great class, I said, honey, you stick with me. I'll take you places you've never gone. We'll do things you've never done. And we will see things you've never seen. And I'll tell you, was I a prophet? Every year from there on in until I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, we made less money. We went up and down the state of California and she saw some places she didn't want to see, none of which she had seen before. The marriage that started out so blissfully, it just degenerated until the time that we hit the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was an endurance contest. It really was. She was unwilling to admit that she had made a mistake again because she didn't want to admit to that. And I knew it was my fault. There is no feeling in this world that gets to me more than several times that I laid in my bed and she pretending to be asleep. I don't know if anybody's ever pretended to be asleep. Pretended to be asleep while she's sobbing her heart out. That I want to go crazy inside, but I can't. Because I rejected that opportunity quite a few years ago. And I know it's my fault. And I don't know what the hell I did. But I know it's my fault. She's crying her heart out. So that's the marriage that I got when I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, my love had clenched back. I had opened up to let somebody else in my heart. And I realized I'd screwed up and I couldn't allow anybody else in. I hit the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Something opened up. The love opened up a little bit more. I came home and Peggy, who had the freedom to share with me, and I tell this story because it's so important to me, is that the man I selected to be my sponsor announced that he would not sponsor anybody who had less than 90 days of sobriety. And that destroyed me. So I figured I had to wait. And I had to wait and get ready. So that when he said yes at 90 days, I could pass the test. Well, the test, by reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take the steps. Well, I wanted to be at 90 days ready to take the steps, and I had passed the test. I didn't think to ask anybody what the hell the test was, so I read the book, and I read the book again. I started reading the book because I wanted to find out what the hell in that book is going to cause me to stay sober for good and for all, because I figured there are things written in that book, and I went, if you have never read it that way, I suggest you try it. It's a hell of a deal. Find out what's written in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that asks you to do, become willing to do, or not stop letting it happen. You can't make it happen, but you can stop things from happening in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the program will happen. So what I called was terms and conditions, things that I must do, become willing to do, or learn how to do in order to stay sober for good and for all. And what I found out, first of all, I had to join Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, if you've never joined Alcoholics Anonymous, there is a requirement. Sure, it's the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking, but it says that we're men and women who share our experience, faith, and hope. And now, if you're like me and you don't know how to share, you damn well better learn. Because you're going to learn if you stay here, sharing. Now, sharing, it happens to be speaking on a topic that is really important to you and being as honest and open-minded as you can possibly be into sharing. Just that simple. I didn't know how to do that. So I walked home to Peg and I said, I'm going to share. And I told her what I was going to do. And she said, and then I said, but when I'm done sharing, because it, see, the deal is I pick a topic that is of really important to me and I share it to the best of my ability, and your job is to sit, listen, don't interrupt, and try to understand. And when I'm done, you can speak on a topic of your choice or mine, and you can be honest and open-minded as you can, and I will be honest, open-minded, and I will not interrupt, and I will try to understand. And I would share. God, she knew how to share. Oh, she knew how to share. I cheated. Hurt so bad. And always sharing would start with, do you remember when? But the book screwed me. It says avoid retaliation. That's a condition you have to learn to accept. Become part of your life. Avoid retaliation. It says that twice in the book. Stupid. And then it screws with your mind. Because it says, fault-finding has to be avoided like the plague. Well, this is no way to build a marriage. Absolutely no way to build a marriage. How in the hell can you stay married to somebody with that sort of an attitude? Well, you see, I had lost all my rights. I didn't have any. I didn't expect anything. I was either going to, this thing was going to take care of itself, so I didn't. I was practicing the principles that I knew. Grasping and developing a manner of living, demanding rigorous honesty. Grasping, holding on too firmly. Developing a gradual process of improvement. A manner of living, demanding rigorous honesty. My definition of honesty in Alcoholics Anonymous is freedom from self-deception. Because I got here and did not know I was a drunk. Now, please, anybody that walks into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and can look at the wreckage they've created in their life and not know they've created a wreckage is so full of it that it's hard to believe, or there are people like myself that for 31 years that I drank alcohol, I had a justified reason and excuse, and for all of that stuff, it never entered my mind that my thinking or the disease of alcoholism had any part of the whole damn package. I just thought I was a rotten, filthy, no good bastard that had no right to live. Good ones died and people like me got to live, and I couldn't understand that way of life. I just couldn't understand it. So freedom from self-deception, and that's my ongoing journey. Because what used to be true yesterday is no longer true. You know, one of the things that talks about are think, think, think. That's one of the things that I use constantly. Think, the first think, if you look at the sign, is first think is the smallest think. It's suspect. I've always acted on my first think, for God's sake. What the hell will I do if I don't have the first think? And then if you look at the sign, the second think is the big one. That's the program think. That's the God think. Think it over. And the third think, which is the medium-sized think, is one, what do you do instead? Bill Wilson confirms that when he says that we will test our thinking with this newfound God awareness. You got to have the second think to test it, for God's sake. Common sense thus becomes uncommon sense. All these things just change your life. Good God, how can you do anything? So you get the only thing that I've decided at the very beginning I could possibly do, all I know is what don't work. Well, now you're screwed. Because you got to do something different. And that's what I did. I had to do something different. It didn't work. So I can't do that anymore. Because I lost the right to argue and persuade and play the managing director and the star of my own play, much as I needed to play the part. And then they screwed me in Rule 62, the most disgusting rule of all. Don't take yourself so damn seriously. I have to tell you a story about Rule 62. That is such a huge impact because somebody said, God, Rule 62, don't take yourself so damn seriously. Chuck told me that. And then I read it in the book, The Fourth Tradition. And I said, God, if I don't, who will? God! The wolf had me! I have a home up in a little town called Magalia. It's a magnificent home. God has been kind to me. It's a magnificent home, and you're all welcome to call. And you can stay the night. Because I can sleep a hell of a lot of people there, and that's the purpose, because I have a large family. All right, and when I went up there, I have a big circular driveway. I have a big circular driveway, and they plowed the snow, because the place that it never snows had 5 feet of snow. They plowed the driveway so that I could come in and unload the furniture in my house. And I was sitting there in my bay window in my kitchen. Bay window in a kitchen. Get serious. With my hassock, with my feet up, drinking my coffee. And some of you have been to my house already. I was looking at Jeff over here, who's been to my house. And we had a little party up there. And I looked at the trees and I counted them. You see, my circular driveway has got an island between the road and my driveway of trees. And it's just like a little park. It's a big one. So I sit there and I counted the trees and I looked and I got 40 of them. And I said, well, it's a little difficult sitting in one place counting trees. So I went out, braved the elements, and I went out in the snow and I counted them. I got 62 trees. Every morning I sit out there and God tells me, John, don't take yourself so damn seriously. Is that a message from God? I have an AA house. It's full of love. It's also kind of empty in certain places, but it's a full house. It's a full house. This is a very special place. Sometimes the feelings that I feel, you know, seem to overwhelm me. Now, I've always known that I felt too much. And it was strangling me because it felt so much. And you know, one of the greatest blessings that has been given to me in sobriety is the ability to feel a lot. And I'm so damned overpaid, it's hard to believe. 5 months after I got sober, my lovely bride looked at me and said, I had what she wanted. And she got involved in the Fellowship of Al-Anon. You see, I know that Peggy, I gave her fulfillment, peace, and joy because she was born to be an Al-Anon. She was just waiting for an alcoholic to happen to her. And I gave it to her. And she took real advantage of my gift, I'll tell you that. I'm responsible almost for the change in a program of Al-Anon because of my contribution to Peggy. Al-Anon will never quite be the same because there's a lady that knew how to love and knew how to do things. And it was very special. I was 4 months sober and I was sitting in the house. And my youngest son was too young to run away. He was only 8. A medical miracle that occurred in the depths of my despair in a town called Fresno. Oh, God, Fresno. When I talk about Fresno, this is the cesspool of creation. They took my dignity, they took my business, they took everything that was ever happened to me. And Fresno is so bad, this is about the only drunk story I will offer because it just is stupid. God, every drunk story is just stupid. Stupid. It has no beginning and it has no end. It's just stupid. I took a drink in Fresno. I came to in Chico. Now that's an indication of how bad Fresno is. I came to in Chico in a $5 a night motel room. I didn't know it was Chico, but I knew it was not a fine hotel that I came to. And I wasn't feeling so very good. And I suddenly realized that I didn't have my jammies on. I always sleep with jammies. I can't sleep without my jammies. And I looked at my body, and I had purple stripes all over it. They were an inch and a half approximately long. They were a quarter of an inch thick. And they were all over my body. They were in places I can't reach. And they were in places that other people shouldn't reach. Now, if you're drunk and you're feeling sick and you stagger into this damn bathroom that is so cheap that doesn't even have a curtain on the stall shower, because you're torn it down because it's so small you bang your elbows every time you try to do anything, and you're thinking about that, you know, this is going to be tough to explain. How did I get wherever the hell I'm at? Where's my jammies? And who in the hell did this to me? And the only thing I'll tell you about that is they washed off. Now that I'm up in the area of Chico, and I've spoke there twice, and each time I've said something like this. Now, since I'm in this area, and if there's anybody out in that audience that knows anything about the Purple Stripes, please talk to me after the woman and after the meeting, and no men need to apply. God, I hope it's a woman that can tell me the story. Jesus. It's a frightening concept. That's it. Stupid story. That's my life story is given in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous when it talks about the jaywalker. Now, there is nothing more stupid than that fool going out there, and the payoff was just exactly what I got, destroying everything that was any value to me whatsoever. You know, and my lovely bride and I had one of the great romances of all times. I don't care what you've had. I've had the greatest romance that God has ever given a man. Because the sharing paid off big numbers. We became close. Those of you and many of you here had the great privilege of knowing the lady and my relationship with her. 4 years ago, she got cancer. On an accident, it was discovered. And she took some chemotherapy, and it was devastating. She fell into the 1% class where it burnt her insides. And she was in great pain. And she had all the dignity in the world, and she did an awful lot of talking. She and I did a lot of talking, and one of the things that she used to talk about was that the disease that she had, lung cancer, is supposedly incurable. That she would be a demonstration of God's miracle or going through this with dignity and grace. And she did. And I had a new role. I truly had a chance to play the loving husband. And our relationship, as good as it was, and God, it was special, turned into something unbelievable. I could cover and I could play the doctor and I could play the nurse and I could mop the floors. She lost control of her bowels. And I had all the joy of drawing closer and closer to the greatest love a man could ever know. She had surgery and I had to pack the wounds. And every day I'd have to, twice a day I'd have to take, she had this gaping wound in her belly. And then I'd have to take the gauze out and I'd clean it and then I'd repack it and then I'd bandage it twice a day. And the intimacy and the sharing was just magnificent. We took a final trip just 5 months ago. We had a great grandchild that she had not met, and she wanted to see her children, and I generally she wanted to see her children in Wyoming, and I really believe she knew the time had come because of the preparations that she had made. And we went to Wyoming. By now she's carrying oxygen. We have oxygen, and I bought a van specifically to carry an oxygen tank around and to make it convenient for her, so that I still have the van. I modified the van so she could lay down and with her feet elevated because of other things that had developed, not side issues to the cancer. And we had a fabulous trip there. And we visited all of her children. And one evening, she got quite ill. We were in a motel. And I finally persuaded her to allow me to dial 911. And they came and they took her, and it's a little town called Pinedale, Wyoming. And they put her into the emergency little clinic they had, and they realized that this was very serious, and They had an ambulance service driver to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and I trailed behind in my car. And unbeknown to anybody and everybody, the cancer had spread to her liver violently. And they had given her pain medication. She went into a coma. And all of my family rallied around. You'll excuse me, but sometimes my voice doesn't do what I want it to do. And God, I love that woman, and I love her today. Anyway, we called our children here in San Jose, and they wanted to fly out to say goodbye because they said that she would not leave the hospital. And then by then it got worse and worse and worse, and finally they put her on some sort of a thing, and I got one daughter and one son that could fly out. No other tickets were available. And they said that she would last maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And I helped her breathe. And every once in a while, someone like Michelle would call. Because they said the hearing is the last thing that goes. Someone like Michelle would call and say goodbye. I was telling Peggy how much I loved her, how much people loved her. And for her to stay alive, I'll help her breathe. 4.5 hours later, our children arrived. And Peggy was there. I had 4.5 hours of the most fabulous times of my life, telling this woman and worshiping the love and care that I had for this lady. They said goodbye. My children said goodbye. We all held hands, and she died 10 minutes later. Love. Oh, my God, the love. Now, I tell you this story because it's mine, and I want to finish it with this. I had no idea. You never know what you're going to say until you say it. I came to this meeting. I was sitting there right over where Bob's sitting, just as shortly after we came back and had the funeral arrangements, and I was in a depth of despair. And, oh, God, pain. The anguish that I felt was overwhelming. And the topic of the meeting was the family after. And I knew, God, don't call on me. Don't call on me. And they didn't. And I got out immediately. I got on my motorcycle and I drove to the ocean, Pescadero Beach, because on our final trip down the coast with Peggy, when she knew she would not be alive, we stopped at the beach so she could take in at the beach, and we sit there for hours and watching the waves roll in on Pismo Beach. I wanted to go there because it's the closest thing I could think of being with Peg. And I was out there on those rocks. I was out there on those rocks, and I was, God, the pain is too great. God, and I was going to think of asking God to take away the pain. But you see, the relationship I have with my loving God, He will do for me things. And I realize, oh my God, I can't ask Him to take away my pain. Because if I do, I might lose some of my joy. Not a chance. All the pain in the world wouldn't count for the love and the joy that I've known with that woman and with you and without Saturday Night Live and with Alcoholics Anonymous and my wonderful relationship with the God of my understanding. Love is so dynamic. Open up your hearts and allow it to happen to you. Give away. Love is not love until you give it away. And it isn't yours anyway. It comes from a power, and the power of love can run out there. I teach meditation. I've taught many times where I teach people how to practice love. It's in us. It'll heal us. It'll make us joyous. It'll allow us to have the good life. Now, I've lived a good life. I'm 73 years old. I've had a wonderful life. The world is a better place because I'm in it. Most assuredly because I'm sober. I love you. And I'm so grateful, and I am truly I can stand before you and say, I've lived a life of no regrets. I've never had it so good. And my house up in Megalia is your house too. Once again, thank you so very much. You've made me, once again, added to the riches. I have already known that I'm the richest man in the world, and I'm certainly the most blessed. Thank you very much.